We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. And we're happy to have back here on the program once again Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign, U of I. And every other month, it is always on a Monday, she's here and we talk about women's health. She comes prepared to talk about a few things that might have been in the news or things that caught her eye that she thinks you might be interested in hearing about. But we are also here to try to answer questions. She's here to try to answer questions. Whenever we have doctors here on the program, I do try to remind people right up front that we can't diagnose over the phone. There's some limits to what we can do. But we do these shows to be a resource for you and have someone here to answer questions. And throughout the year, various times, we have physicians who specialize in different things on the program. And Dr. Troopin has been here on the program for a long time doing those shows with us, and we're pleased that she could be here. So questions are certainly welcome. She'll, I know, do her best to answer questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good, anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And you may also email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, why don't I? We do, in fact, have an email. It came in here just a little bit, actually, even before we got going, from someone who would like you to comment on a recent report of problems with taking Actonel for an extended period of time. And the person here says that means over 5 years. So taking Actonel for an extended period of time for women who are osteopenic.
So what this email is referring to is the treatment of a patient for the prevention of bone prevention of osteoporosis. So if somebody has osteopenia, we say they have low bone mass. And if someone has low bone mass, in fact, they are at a slightly increased risk for having an osteoporotic fracture. Many people have been diagnosed with osteopenia just based on their simple bone density tests where their spine and their hip were x-rayed. A more accurate bone density test would also include what we call a VFA or vertebral fracture analysis. So some people actually have silent fractures that would have moved them from osteopenia into osteoporosis. So not everybody's been 100% diagnosed, and you have to, if we have a patient and we're counseling on an individual basis, we want to be as clear as possible what the diagnosis was, how that was made, and how the data should be interpreted. We do know that all bone treatments that are in the class of medicines that Actonel's in, the bisphosphonates, will slow down the turnover of bone metabolism. Bones do need to turn over to stay healthy, and that if you slow that bone metabolism down for too long, then that is potentially a reverse problem. So in the beginning, you slow your bone metabolism down, you add bone thickness, or at least you don't lose bone, and therefore fractures are prevented, or the future fractures that you may incur are prevented. It's not just people who have osteopenia, but people who have osteoporosis that need that bone turnover to some extent. And what is considered short-term use and what is considered long-term use in these medicines has just been an evolving question with respect to experts. So that in the past, we used to consider that these people would have a diagnosis, that they may or may not need almost permanent treatment. There were 312 cases of atypical femur fracture, so you can think of it as your thigh bone, reported worldwide in people on bisphosphonates, not just the drug Actonel. Actonel is ricindrenate. Ricindrenate will come in a couple of different forms. There's a medicine called Ataliva that is a form of the ricindrenate that is actually a once-a-week medicine and can be actually taken with food, which is a big advance because the other medicines like Actonel never could be taken with food. You always had to avoid eating for stretches of time. Actonel comes, it actually still comes as a daily form. Nobody prescribes it that way, but it can come as a weekly prescription. Nobody really prescribes Actonel that way, but monthly is often what people are taking. There's so many different variations. And Actonel is a cousin of medicines like Fosfomax, which is alendronate, and Beneva, which is another bisphosphonate, and Reclast, which is called zoledronic acid, has a slightly different name. And Reclast is given intravenously once a year. All of these medicines will slow down bone turnover, and we think that the entire class of medicines actually could be associated with these atypical fractures. And it is, if somebody is presenting with thigh pain, something that we do look for, again, extraordinarily rare. It's gotten some of us thinking that patients who have been on these medicines somewhere in the range of 5 to 10 years either need a bone medicine holiday, or perhaps they've gotten all the benefit that they're going to get from this class of medicine and they need to come off. The FDA has not pulled any of these medicines off. They've not really even felt that the level of risk is so significant because, like I said, 312 cases worldwide on a scale of literally millions of prescriptions. So it's real. We do want patients also now to consider what is their risk of fracture. And if your risk of fracture isn't great at the present time, do you need to be on medicine now, or is it going to be better to wait until your fracture risk is greater? And that's where we work with our patients to calculate what's called a FRAX score, F-R-A-X, and it can easily be found on the National Osteoporosis Foundation website, nof.org, which I think we've probably talked about this score before, but it's what the World Health Organization recommends that physicians and healthcare providers use when counseling their patients regarding risk.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets to the question. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's here on the program every other month. We talk about women's health. She's always here on a Monday. And we do have a couple of callers here. We'll get them in, and we'll go next to somebody who is listening in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm hoping you can help in a general sense, if you can say anything at all about the X-rays for breast cancer. I have a family member who announced to everybody, I'm no longer doing X-rays for breast cancer. I've been looking it up on the Internet, and it's not necessary. And I don't slice the idea where she's been on the Internet, so I don't have any way to ask questions and to determine, you know, is this some sort of crazy person, you know, says take my salve, you don't have to worry about anything, or whether or not the general medical opinion has changed from when I first was involved with this, with X-rays, which was, I think, either annually or every 2 years. So is there some sort of change, or is it just simply a determination by the general practitioner? Because he always sends letters talking about, you know, you're ready, it's time for you to take your X-ray.
So,
and I'm concerned about the role modeling for the younger girls coming up in the family to get some sort of idea on this, if you could give it to me. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, okay.
So essentially, the story with breast cancer is how do we most accurately make a diagnosis, because we know that if a breast cancer is diagnosed extraordinarily early that it is quite treatable. And for people who do have their breast cancers caught by quote-unquote x-rays, and we like to use the term mammogram for an x-ray of the breast, although mammogram is a more global term, but most people who are having mammograms are in fact getting an x-ray of their breast. And if we look at that group of patients who only found extremely early breast cancer on mammography, they will have somewhere between a 97 and a 99% survival. In other words, they will die of something else. So we still consider it a very important tool. Most organizations that are out there, American Cancer Society, AMA even probably, I think, weighs in on this, but the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, American College of Family Practice, the American College of Radiology, and many groups recommend using these breast x-rays to find breast cancers early in a treatable stage, and it will save lives. And there are new research studies that even back that up, and the lives they save are significant numbers for those of us in the American population. The x-rays are extremely accurate. Now, we think that there is a specific class of patients, and if you go on the American Cancer Society's website, we can look at the fact that patients who have extremely high-risk genetic makeup, such as those that are BRCA1 or 2 positive, they are potentially sensitive to radiation, and that the more radiation these women get, the more increased risk they have of developing a cancer. And in this small population, if she can swing it with her insurance and so forth, it is healthier for that population to, in fact, get their mammograms done without radiation with magnetic resonance imaging. It's a much more time-consuming test. It's a much more expensive test. And it's a problematic test for the average woman because we will find more things to biopsy if we start giving MRIs to everybody. But there is that small class of people. So if somebody in your family has a BRCA 1 or 2 gene, and you can work with your own healthcare provider to try to figure out if that is the case in your genetics, then you may be a family that needs to look in another direction. Now, having said all of this, there are those that say that we need to irradiate women's breasts a little bit less, and that's where the United States Preventive Task Force, USPTF, came out with their recommendations to only do age 50 to 74 every other year. Most organizations will start at age 40 and continue much past age 74. So there is some controversy, and going to their website at the USPFT, if I said it right somewhere along the line, will give you a lot of information about that. There are also going to be bigger, better machines out there, and we're looking at breast tomograms, 3D MRIs, and different things like that. And as we move into an era of better imaging, I think we will have less radiation exposure, more accuracy, better health.
And just to follow up on your point that there might be some people who, because of their genetic makeup, might be at greater risk for breast cancer. And so then you might want to minimize your radiation exposure. Everybody's not going to have that. I mean, that test, that's something you have to go out and have done.
It's a $3,500 blood test. If your insurance doesn't feel that history is in your family, you're not going to get that. But genetic testing is really the way we're going. Mm-hmm. And when I see patients and counsel them about whether or not they should have that genetic test, we get more into risks and benefits and other things you can do to reduce your risk as well as avoid radiation.
But that is the kind of thing that again, we'll set the cost aside, that if you have a significant family history of breast cancer,
absolutely,
you might, and you're in a position to have the test done, you might want to think about doing
right.
That.
So another place where people can easily go on the web at nci.org www.nhs.gov. National Health Institute uses the GAIL scale, G-A-I-L, to calculate breast cancer risk. And you can Google the GAIL scale. You'll come up with tons of websites, and you can just play around with those numbers. That is just one scale for calculation of breast cancer risk. There are several others, but it's a good one.
All right. Let's take another caller here. And this is someone in Chicago and line one. Hello.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm a 64-year-old woman with uterus. I was on hormone replacement therapy for about 10 years, and I've been off since 2005 for 6 years. In that period of time, I have gained weight. My mood swings are horrendous. I don't have night flashes, the sweats. The progesterone, according to a cardiologist, is risky for my age. Do you know any recommendations? Have they researched it a little more of something that could help me with my quality of life?
Well, there's a lot of research.
There's
a tremendous amount of research, and of the women who were probably like you and got on hormone replacement therapy as they transitioned through menopause, we still feel that that is very safe. It is very beneficial for prevention of heart disease. As we get to women who are also somewhat like you, mid to early 60s, not currently on any hormone replacement therapy, haven't been on any therapy for 5 or more years. They haven't really, there's no magic number of years, but just basically walk in the front door, somebody in their mid 60s who's not on hormone replacement therapy, we feel that if we started that group on hormone replacement therapy, that that group is going to have increased incidence of a number of cardiovascular side effects, including increased risk of heart attacks, increased risks of stroke, increased risk of pulmonary embolism, increased risk of deep vein thrombosis, and that the risk-benefit ratio for somebody to newly start systemic hormone replacement therapy is usually not on the side of benefit versus risk. Having said that, it really doesn't apply to the use of vaginal estrogen, which is separate, and I've talked about it another time. But in terms of weight, there's not, so of the two things that you started out saying in terms of weight and mood swings, there's never been a study that someone in their mid-60s could start hormone replacement therapy and lose weight. So as a goal to lose weight or significantly modify your weight with that therapy in your mid-60s probably would not be successful. In terms of moods, there have been a number of studies actually looking at all the different therapies that stabilize mood, and several of them have had significant benefit in terms of the menopausal woman and her moods, and do have benefit. So it certainly is possible to see your own healthcare provider, really target what therapies can help you lose weight, because there are medical therapies that do help people lose weight, and what therapies could help you improve your mood, because there are therapies that do help patients improve their mood as well.
Well, there was a study that I did read that they did with diabetes, that postmenopausal women have a tendency to gain weight in the abdominal after quitting the HRT, the hormone replacement therapy. And, of course, you're protected when on hormone replacement therapy, because it seems to balance the weight distribution once the estrogen, you know, you have estrogen in your body. And it sort of keeps a balance. But I've noticed that I've gained a lot of weight in the abdominals. And I'm concerned about what's underneath that, not so much the protrusion, but the diabetes that they say does occur after, stopping hormone replacement therapy.
So most of those studies have been confounded by multiple factors that lead to those same issues. So one thing that you can do in terms of your body composition is find out accurately what your body composition is. And then as you go forward into time, you can look at how your body is responding and if your body composition is adequately responding. So my lunar prodigy bone densitometer actually will give very accurate body fat measurements and body distribution. And then as people diet, we can find out, are you losing fat mass? Are you losing lean mass? What's your physiology doing in response to whatever is being tried? We know that there are many ways to test for diabetes. So you do want to be treated if you have early diabetes or if you have a pre-diabetic state. By treating that, you can help to prevent it from going forward. When we've looked at abdominal girth studies in patients on estrogen and off estrogen, we do know that when your own ovaries make estrogen at a pretty high level, your abdominal fat is less than in menopausal status. But when we look at hormone replacement therapy, some of the studies have shown benefit on the waistline in the area of 1 to 2 centimeters. It's not even an inch, you know. So, you know, that's nice. Nobody would balk at losing half an inch if they could. But it isn't percentage-wise enough to outweigh the risks that somebody would be taking on. So that we try to use other therapies. And I'll be enrolling a study this summer looking at alternative therapies other than hormone replacement for women who are having menopausal symptoms. Although, like other menopausal studies, we usually specifically look for people that are having hot flashes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. You've been very helpful.
Well, thank you. We're about at a midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist, has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the med school. And every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, she's here and we talk about women's health. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, while we're on the subject of hot flashes, let me just ask you about this because it's an article that we came across that looked kind of interesting. And it apparently has to do with a study that has found that there might actually be a positive benefit to hot flashes. I know women who've had them would say, ha, you're kidding me. But according to some research, it turns out that women who have had these episodes in their 50s or 60s, which is the typical age range for menopausal symptoms, they also have an 11% lower risk of heart disease over the next 10 years if you compare them with women who did not have those same symptoms. Why should
I know,
that be?
And I know I got slipped that article just as I was.
I know you wouldn't give me very much chance to think about it.
I'm doing my coat, and it is a very provocative study. When we look at medical information, we try to look at what we call risk factors and risk markers. And I am reading that study, and they're talking about it being a risk factor and putting forward some biological plausibility to protection of your blood vessels when you actually have this hot flash and subsequent hormonal surges coming forward. I'm sort of paraphrasing because I barely looked at the article and I do want to study it more. My thinking is that it's probably a risk marker and that as brilliant as those researchers probably are, I think that we may be overlooking some things. For instance, if we literally just start every year or every 2 to 5 years doing an EKG, a heart study on women over the age of 55, we will find a lot of asymptomatic, untreated cardiovascular conditions, like doing a mammogram. And we, American College of OBGYN just came out with, I think they call themselves American Congress. We changed our name. They go by both for different purposes. But they just came out with their recommendations for annual screenings. And they don't have EKG in there as an annual screen. American Heart Association is trying to move towards more routine screening of EKGs. And I'm trying to move that direction with some of my patients as well. And if I had to guess, I would say that these patients came under scrutiny more. You have hot flashes, you tend to have palpitations, your doc checks out your heart, your doc checks out your cholesterol, your doc tells you to eat right. I think something else might have been going on, or maybe there was something physiologic about that patient. Maybe she had higher estrogen levels going into menopause, and as she transitioned through, she was somebody more likely to become symptomatic as she transitioned through, but those high estrogen levels maybe set her heart up at some point nicely so that her hot flashes showed that she had better heart. I don't know. I'm just thinking of other ways of looking at that data. But
well, I guess to me, though, something that you just said, to me, this is something important, that if we went out and we assembled randomly a group of women in this age range who at first glance seemed not to have any symptoms of heart disease, and we did a really thorough workup of them,
correct,
we would find significant numbers of them had cardiac issues and they didn't have any symptoms.
I think so, because especially the way our heart is rotated in our chest and the way that we get symptoms when a guy has a heart attack, it's what you expect on television, crushing pain, pain of the chest, pain shooting down your arm and up in your neck.
Yeah.
Women are like, you know, I got this backache. And not everybody, of course, but very often they say it's because women have that different frame of reference. We've been through childbirth and what is quote unquote awful pain to us is maybe not as intense as we should be reporting.
Well, I think that, again, that's an important thing, is that the symptoms of heart disease in women, they present differently. And for that reason, I think some people have said that for a long time now, we haven't been paying the amount of attention that we should to women and cardiac issues that we have to men.
I think also they were on estrogen, like the caller said. Maybe they were protected.
Well, it could be. I don't know. All right. Very good. Well, we have some other callers here, and we'll go on and talk with someone in Champaign next, line number one. Hello. Caller.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Back to Actonil. How long does that drug stay in your system once you stop taking it?
That's a good question. And Actonil has a very fast metabolism. That is why ricindronate as a way of treating bone loss is very important for the spine, where women tend to lose their bone mass on the early side. Actonil has this very quick start because they get a quick uptake and it is not in your body as long. So it has a turnover in the range of days, whereas medications that are cousin medications may have turnovers as long as years. And so, yes, even stopping the medicine will persist in having some of that medicine permanently incorporated in your bone for a stretch. We need to remember that we turn over our whole body. Our whole body will, just like our bones, our whole body probably changes over about every 10 years. So sooner or later, we turn most things over, but not as completely as we would want.
Thank you.
All right, very good. And let's see, we'll go on and talk with another call. This is someone in Villa Grove and line two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah,
I am 72 years old, and I had been on Fosamax and then Actonil for about as long as these products have been out. I have Paget's disease, and then 2 years ago, I got reclassed instead, and after I was referred to an endocrinologist. I had had I'm going to call them tingling and twitches in my leg, and this led me to being put on reclass at the endocrinologist's suggestion. What do you think? Do I need a holiday from these medicines?
So the drug holiday research and talk has primarily been in people treating or preventing the condition osteoporosis. And You should feel special and unique because of Paget's disease is not a common disease. And people listening probably don't even know what it is beyond its term. And it is a specific kind of bone disease. And the breakthrough of using these medicines for Paget's was really quite remarkable. And it took a lot of hard work to gather up groups of people with Paget's disease, because even experts sometimes are only following maybe 5 or 6 of these patients at one time. So you really do have to work with your endocrinologist when having such a fine point question like this. One thing people tend to forget, or I find my patients tend to forget, and even some other healthcare providers, is that these medicines are designed to put our calcium into our bones. Mm-hmm. Our body and our muscles, our brain, our heart, but our leg muscles, they all need calcium to work. So that when you take these medicines, it's critical to make sure, number one, that your calcium level is good when you start the medicine, and number two, make sure that your calcium is good as you move forward in the treatment. And for people whose calcium is taken out of the bloodstream, put into the bones, and you don't have enough for your circulating every day, beating of your heart and contracting of your leg muscles, you can have some side effects. And so if someone comes to me on these kinds of medicines and they have peripheral symptoms like tinging and twitches and things like that, I always like to start with what's going on with that blood calcium or even urine calcium. Mm-hmm. Are we turning over our calcium properly?
Okay, I understand.
And that may not be appropriate for your case, but in general, I find many people have gotten started on these medicines without a calcium level or not one ever tracked. And I try to remind our patients that that's one very good use of routine blood work.
So I should really check with my endocrinologist and see if she thinks that I need to have a holiday from this medicine.
Right.
And
with the reclass, again, in osteoporosis patients, they have found a suppression of bone turnover for 2 to 3 years. So for some patients, they don't even need a once-a-year reclass. They could get one every 2 to 3 years, which 15 minutes every 2 to 3 years, that's kind of nice.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Very good. Bye-bye. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Piatt County for another caller. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've just been listening, and I feel lazy. I haven't done the research myself, so I'll ask your advice on this also. Is that 4 years ago, I had a series of chemotherapy and radiation for cancer, and then I just finished a round of radiation for ductal carcinoma in situ. And so I'm just wondering, are there any studies that I should be looking at for long-term effects of radiation? I feel like I've had a lot of radiation, and I just wonder is there something I can read, or can I assume that, because I'm really healthy, I am really well, and I just wonder, are there long-term effects or studies done on long-term effects of double doses of radiation?
So you bring up many good points. There are many studies of long-term effects of radiation. More of those studies have been directed at young individuals who were treated when they were very young or teens, and their longer-term risks of getting other cancers down the line. And there are probably a lot of good sites you can go to for information about that. I would assume that WebMD has a lot of good information. American Cancer Society should have some information on their site. And definitely the American College of Radiology has some papers on that and what kinds of screenings people should have who have had previous treatment. Anyone with a prior breast cancer is also at risk for other cancers down the line. So when you talk about radiation prevention, you're not really in a position to stop getting mammograms. Assuming you have breasts, you don't need to say that over the radio. But one of the important things to remember about breast ductal carcinoma in situ is that back when we first came up with mammograms, that represented about, some people even said 1%, but no more than 3% of all the breast cancer diagnosed. And there have been recent studies where DCIS is about 30% of the breast cancers diagnosed, and they are treated like any other actual invasive breast cancer. They're treated very aggressively with chemotherapy and radiation, and to good end. There are many fewer overall recurrences with that. And yet, on the other hand, it's one of the things that we point to that has really changed about this disease. And there are still some question marks about the early diagnosis and the aggressiveness of the therapy amongst some experts. And that's probably, when you follow the literature, what you're going to stumble upon more so than even subsequent risk, because you still are at a greater risk for recurrent breast cancer.
Okay. So just check the websites and
check the websites, and there's a lot written on these subjects. I've seen articles in the New York Times. I've seen probably Wall Street Journal articles. There's quite a bit in the media that's very well researched. And, of course, your own provider, or you could seek consultation with a oncologist that takes care of breast cancer in our community in Champaign. Probably the biggest breast center that we're actually close to is in Peoria at Susan Komen, and there's a big Indianapolis breast center, and there are two or three breast centers in Chicago that are quite renowned as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your help.
All right, very good. Thank you. We are coming to the point here. We have maybe about 12 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area, teaches at the med school, and every other month is here, and we talk about women's health. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And I do actually have another email here from someone who writes that she had an ultrasound which found a lot of fibroids in her uterus. A month earlier, a cyst was discovered on her left ovary. So she'd like to have you talk about causes, treatments, things to watch for. She adds that she is in her mid-40s.
So fibroids is the common name for a medical term, leiomyomata, that stands for a muscle knot of the uterus itself. Those muscles, cells of the uterus are spindle-shaped. They tend to whirl around on each other and form these little hard, almost the consistency of one of those super hard rubber bouncy balls, muscle knots. They can occur within the wall of the uterus, hanging within the cavity of the uterus, hanging off the uterus itself. In research studies where we just round women up and look at their uterus under ultrasound, we find that in women in their 40s, approximately one-third will have uterine fibroids. Now, most of these are completely asymptomatic. Some are extremely treatable by a actual surgical procedure called resection, where we just scrape out the lining of the uterus. And there's actually a relatively new tool that's just been used called the MyoSure. It's essentially like a really miniaturized Roto-Rooter. You can get rid of fibroids hanging in the cavity of the uterus literally in seconds. Under local anesthesia, it's great. And then there are medications such as Lupron, which are approved to actually shrink fibroids in somebody that has a big bulk mass. There's a radiologic procedure to take a big bulk mass of a symptomatic fibroid and shrink, essentially starve the uterus after clogging up its blood supply, and the uterus will shrink down, and that procedure is called a uterine artery embolization. So while about three-quarters of all hysterectomies in the U.S., and we have about three-quarters of a million hysterectomies in the U.S. each year, and over half of those have been done for heavy menstrual bleeding. Now we have ways of handling heavy menstrual bleeding that is completely separate from doing a hysterectomy. We can even just treat the lining of the uterus, which sheds, by doing an overture. And so there are many alternatives for these fibroids, but it all depends on the size, the symptoms, the actual location in the uterus, your long-term goals. Is somebody who's perhaps maybe your age, but perhaps younger, still trying to have children. So many things have to be decided with your healthcare provider before you can decide on the management of fibroids. Ovarian cysts also are extremely common. And unfortunately, in medicine, we only have one medical term that describes a little fluid-filled collection in the ovary, and that is the word cyst. It might be one of the most overused and overly scary words. And what you really need to know about anything that is described in your ovary as a cyst is this just ovulation? Was this something that everybody has? Is it a follicle, which is an egg forming in your ovary? Is it a corpus luteum, which is the result of the egg having ovulated out of your ovary? Is it truly an actual cyst that should be something concerning? And so trying to then put the cyst together with the fibroid, it's not really possible just knowing that description, but they often are completely separate.
All right. Again, we have just maybe about 5 minutes left, maybe 7, 8 minutes left. And again, I think that I have another email here that, we have somebody who was interested. I was saying about a year ago there were some ads on television for the Bloom study regarding diminished interest in sex in postmenopausal women. And I kind of think this was also in connection with some sort of product that they were some sort of treatment.
Testosterone gel.
Yeah.
And they have a great website, and it is still enrolling.
So the person who was interested in whether, in fact, there were any results.
Any results.
Yes.
So there have been preliminary results from the Bloom trial produced. The Bloom trial has several groups of patients. So one was a group that of women that is menopausal secondary to losing their ovaries, and looking at the short-term success or not success treatment of libido with that testosterone gel. And the Bloom study also is enrolling a long-term safety study, and that study is looking for women who are menopausal, who are either over the age of 70 and have low libido, or between the ages of menopausal age and 70, who have cardiovascular risk factors of one sort or another. And we are looking at the 5-year safety of Libigel relative to heart disease and breast cancer, as well as looking at the efficacy to improve libido with testosterone gel in this population. They have produced some of the interim results, and the results essentially look as good as the results with the Intrinsa patch, if anybody's remembering the testosterone patch, which some studies are still going on with the testosterone patch. But women do have an increase in libido. In the Bloom study, they don't track as much episodes of intercourse, but as the way they did in the Intrinsa patch. But the side effect profile is relatively low, and the improvements were very meaningful for the patients in those groups. And we find that so far the reported data does show safety. And if people that are within our listening area are still interested in the Bloom study, they could call my office or just pop online and look at the Bloom study. I think it's bloomstudy.com, but you can Google it.
Yeah.
You'll find it.
Yeah. I found some, just by putting Bloom study into the browser, I found some stuff on it. So that shouldn't be difficult. We do want to do at least one more caller here. Savoy, line one.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I've heard your guest use the phrase healthcare provider several times, and I recognize that that's increasingly fashionable terminology nowadays. And with HIT and the ONC and Obamacare, there's probably going to be more and more people want to be known as healthcare providers. But I was wondering, who else other than a medical doctor knows anything about these things that you've been talking about this morning?
Well, it is a good point. And I, over the years, have employed certified nurse midwives and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. And I think that there is a huge place for a structured care in terms of
yes, but none of them know anything about the intricacies of which you've been speaking today.
Well, I would disagree that I think that of women in my field who, and they have been women, they don't have to be a woman, but of those providers in my field that have those the allied healthcare professional degrees, many of them do have a very high level of sophistication of understanding of these matters. And you get to the point where even some generalist physicians don't have...
Oh, but they're physicians.
No. Those allied healthcare professionals are not. But also, when we say healthcare provider, you might be getting your pap smear from a gynecologist. You might be getting your pap smear from a family practice physician. You might also be getting your pap smear from, say, an internist. So when I say those things, I don't want to denigrate anybody's health care because much of it is extremely good.
Well, I think it'll be easier for everybody if you just use the term doctor. Bye-bye.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left here.
We've talked so much about the menopause, and there was a story of looking specifically at women in menopause, and there was a University of Arizona nutrition study that studied 73,000 older American women. I thought that was quite...
That's a pretty good size.
Very good size.
Sample.
And they said that women are 21% more likely to develop actual anemias than males of the same age. And just they found links specifically between anemia and poor nutrition in their studies. And they said that the group of menopausal patients were more likely to be actually missing their requisite amounts of protein, folic acid, vitamin B12, vitamin C, and iron. And in general, this group ate a paucity of red meat, which I would generally say is good, but maybe that accounted for them being lower in those specific nutrients. So again, as we move forward into healthcare, whether with our physicians or with our non-physician providers, I think that if you have somebody who has symptoms, we had a caller who was 64 and she was complaining of a whole myriad of symptoms. We know that when you're nutritionally deficient, such as anemic, you actually gain weight. People who have poor sleep, they actually gain weight. Of course, lacking exercise. But if you are anemic, you're going to lack exercise. You're not going to have proper energy to even spend the calories during your walk with your next door neighbor or whatever you're doing. Yeah. So actually now I've moved into actually trying to get some blood levels of various vitamins, looking for more specific deficiencies in patients with complaints. So that might be a thought for some patients working with their own physicians.
Well, it might be that the women wouldn't be thinking it, when a time of her life when one was having periods, she's losing some blood every month. Well, okay, then you might think anemia might be an issue. I guess I would think that when you get into this patient population, that wouldn't be right away something that I would think about. But here, this is now generally associated with maybe just a general kind of lack of all-around nutrition.
Exactly.
And why do you think that?
Well, this particular article I was reading didn't go into a lot of the whys. Some might have to do with even finances in terms of what you're doing. Some may have to do with food habits. If you get less tolerant of certain kinds of foods, you move towards foods that you are tolerant of, but you end up restricting your diet and not getting as wide a range of nutrients. So there may be a number of things. that we can look at. And again, usually these studies are the springboard to, to the actual answer rather than the answer itself.
We maybe have about a minute or so left.
I would just like to say that of the other, I mentioned the Bloom study. We do have a research study looking for patients with heavy menstrual bleeding and polyps or fibroids. We have another study enrolling looking for women who've had a what's called recurrent endometriosis, so that they've had treatments for endometriosis in the past, and now they are perhaps looking for another round of treatment, and we are working with a novel medicine there, so that's an exciting study. And we still are enrolling our teen bone health study, looking for teens that are or young women between ages 12 and 18 who are using oral are interested in going on oral contraceptives, and we are going to study their bone health for a year while they're on a couple of different formulations of oral contraception. So those are the main things. We have an overactive bladder study for someone who urinates too much coming up in the spring as well.
Okay. Well, I think for that, for now, we'll wrap it up with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month, and it is always on a Monday, she is here to talk about women's health and has been doing that with us for a long time. And we thank you very much.
Thank you.